Hello, and welcome to the Future of London City Bites podcast. I'm Fran Lord, Head of Communications and Engagement at Future of London, and this episode is the first in our City of Tomorrow series, which we're releasing in partnership with Montagu Evans. This series will see us explore some of the hot topics facing the capital in the near future, from high street regeneration to the future of workplaces. Today, we'll be discussing how we can address the challenge of ensuring tall buildings in the capital are socially inclusive. For now, I'll hand over to our chair, Chris Mealy from Montagu Evans. Over to you, Chris.
Well, hello, I'm Chris Mealy. I'm a town planner and a partner at Montagu Evans. We're property consultants, and I have a lot of experience of tall buildings, which I think is relevant to the question we're going to be answering and addressing this morning, which is it possible for tall buildings to be socially sustainable? I'm joined by two other experts in this area, whom I'll ask to introduce themselves. First, Frank Filskow. Frank?
Hi, I'm Frank Filskow from Make Architects. Over the last 18 years, we've produced and led a number of designs for tall buildings of various scales all over central London. And we're currently looking at research on how we can improve social diversity and inclusivity, in particular in urban locations, and thinking about how that affects tall buildings as well.
Well, thanks, Frank. And now I'd like to pass over to Claire to introduce herself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Claire Benny. I'm an architect, and I was also development director at Peabody. And now I run my own business, Municipal, which advises public sector housing clients on how to improve the quality of their new homes programs. And in particular, I've done a piece of work for One London Borough, looking at whether families should live in high rise.
Well, I suppose the question that we've been set, can tall buildings be sustainable, presumes that they aren't. And it also begs the question, therefore, about what is sustainable development. Now, as a planner, I think of that in terms of national or government policy. And that tells us that sustainability has three limbs. It's got a social component, an environmental component, and an economic component. And of course, carbon, which is a big point about sustainability now, cuts across all those three. Is a big policy topic and might be one we return to. But I'd like to start specifically with the social, which I think is the focus for our question today, and start with Frank, really, and ask you what you see the main challenges that the sector is facing around making tall buildings socially inclusive. Frank?
Yes, definitely a challenge. And I think I'm optimistic, though, that they can be more socially inclusive. But I think, first of all, it's really important to recognise that diversity and housing supply needs to consider all different types of typologies, and tall buildings have a role to play in that, in particular in central urban locations, because fundamentally tall buildings are very valuable because they protect the use of land, the excessive use of land, which is in particularly short supply in the UK. More than anywhere, really. So I think they have a role to play, but there is definitely a challenge. We have seen, though, some problems. I think the first thing that I wanted to kind of open with is a commentary on the way development happens in the UK in particular, and the presumption and the appetite for developers to basically build small, very small units, especially in central locations, because of a perceived high value and a reluctance to build family units. And that's kind of linked into the kind of the British mentality of family units and larger units are not suitable in tall buildings. But I think there is a role to play. I think we need to look at families broadly and remember that families don't necessarily mean little kids. They also mean grown-ups and teenagers, and that needs change over time. But also the different parts of tall buildings have different roles to play in that. I mean, that's the beginnings of the challenge. And we're starting to see, I've started to see certainly a progression where buildings are getting better at it, but there's still a long way to go.
Well, thanks, Frank, for a start kicking us off. Claire, are you optimistic in the way that Frank is? And what, you know, what's your take on it?
I would say I'm probably not quite as optimistic as Frank, but I'm just going to come at this from a research angle for a moment. I've had the good fortune to be able to do some worldwide social and desktop research into should families be at high rise recently. And I think almost all research says don't put families at high rise. yes, this might be a sort of UK propensity not to like it. There's plenty of families in high rise in Hong Kong, Singapore, and increasingly in Canada and Australia as well. But I think taller buildings, and we, of course, we need to define what we mean by that. I'm going to say over seven stories, which might sound quite small, but actually that's the pinch point at the moment, just are not great for children and especially preschool children. There's just numerous issues around freedom to play, ability to supervise, residual play ending up in corridors and lifts, high concentrations of young people being a bit cross about this and acting out, and space standards not being great. And just the danger of open windows and balconies are a really obvious one as well. You can mitigate all that, of course, and people do. People have fantastic play spaces on podiums and roofs. You can put a very close park nearby with excellent play. But those are always going to be mitigations in the end. So my view, sort of summing that up, is that a tall building has to be conceived in its ecosystem. You know, it has to border a secure shared garden. It has to make a social offer at ground floor, storage facilities for buggies, etc. But as I say, I think there are always mitigations. The other thing I'd like to talk about in a moment is whether it's affordable to live in these buildings, which is, of course, a social issue.
We'll hold that thought, Claire, because it is fundamental and it cuts across lots of areas. I mean, I think just an observation, of course, that when a local authority comes to determine an application for any building, and including a tall building, they have to try to achieve the whole spread of size of accommodation on every site. And that's just a function of the way our system works legally. It's not to say I don't take your point, it's a good point. I mean, Frank, you know, Claire has raised some really good practical points based on evidence that she's been gathering. And I know you've had to grapple with this problem, but thinking now about, you know, particular examples, which is an area we want to explore, this subject of how perhaps multi-generational tall buildings might work, or particularly this point around children that Claire makes, which I certainly have seen come up in discussions with local authorities recently about this form of development. So, Frank, could you maybe respond to that particular point and make any other points you think about that are relevant?
Yeah, and I think it's common sense. I don't think it would be sustainable or intelligent to suggest that you can build a whole tall building for young families. But I think we're starting to think about, as you make the point, a more multi-generational approach. So, for example, young families, older families, but also retired people, single people, young professionals, or later life couples, or what I call second life, as people who perhaps have restarted their life after their children have left home. There's a huge diversity. And we're starting to say, if you actually look at the range of different homes or families or homesteads, it maybe is a better word, we're starting to try to move away from this very narrow view of, is it a one bed, is it a two bed, or is it a family home? And say, well, those definitions aren't actually real anymore. A three-bedroom home could be a penthouse. A three-bedroom family home for young kids is different from a family home for a couple, perhaps with a 20-year-old son who hasn't left home. So we're trying to get into the nuance of it. And I think this is where tall buildings can work. In conjunction, I think Claire makes the point, you know, there are different parts of different buildings. And when you work them together, they really start to give you opportunities. So the most successful things we've done to begin with, and it's only beginnings of the steps, is where you combine tall buildings with other buildings and placemaking and courtyards. And then in different parts of the building, you have different types of tenure or types of unit, so that you're starting to say lower down family units suitable for younger kids, maybe just in the first few stories. And then as you move up the building, you can have different types of layouts rather than thinking of the whole building as one type of thing. And don't think of a building as a single, it should be a vertical village. And you can have, and some people love being at the top of a building. There's a very high quality of life you can get when you have a fantastic view and sunshine and those things in one way. But obviously there are other limitations. And I think amenity and people's choices, the diversity of choice, is perhaps a way to look at this that could help.
Well, thanks, Frankie. Claire, can you give us some examples, because you've been doing this wonderful piece of research, I think we all look forward to having a look at in due course, but some real practical examples about where you see this working in London, because that's our primary frame of reference, but other places too.
So in London, I would point to a particular estate, which was actually a 1970s estate called the World's End, built in the 70s in Kensington and Chelsea. And that is interesting because it's got the benefit of having been around for 50 years and therefore has it worked or not? Well, I think the jury might say, yes, it has. It's got all kinds of uses at ground floor. It's got a school which you don't have to cross the road to get to. It's got fantastic podium level open spaces, which anyone can use, anyone and everyone. It's also got really amazing access decks, which are must be at least 2, if not 3 meters wide, which allows children to play on their doorsteps. So many things about this place are right. I noticed an over 50s social club as well, which kind of nearly really frightened me because I suddenly realized I would be eligible to go and use that. But coming back to Frank's point about who loves living in like this, there's surprisingly little actual social research and evidence about if people genuinely like living in these places. And I can't, in another life, I would like to do that. My personal view, and it's very personal and it's backed up by zero evidence, is that towers on the whole are really only a good format to live in for a very small minority of households. I think that might be something like 5%. And that's actually fine because there's plenty of other stock for everyone else to live in. But for me, those households really do have to be well off in order to afford to live there and to afford the maintenance charges and so forth. And they have to be mobile without kids, and people also with choices about where to live so that if their life changes, they can move to another type of home. So that means that in my world, towers should only be about 5% of homes. And in London, there are about 3.5 million homes, and that would mean about 200,000 homes could be in towers. And I've calculated that that means about 100 taller buildings in each inner London borough. And I would strongly suggest also that towers are really only viable in inner London. I've covered a lot there, but I do think at the core of what I've said is that there is not a huge appetite to live like that, but there certainly is an appetite amongst a particular clientele.
Well, thanks, Claire, for that. I think there's a couple of interesting points emerged from that exchange around that topic, particularly the idea of balancing out types of accommodation across an estate, which is your World's End example, which I agree, and I know that estate, and I agree with everything you say about that, really. Contrasting, interestingly, maybe with Robin Hood Gardens, which was spectacularly a failure as a family plan and technically tall building estate. But Frank, what do you make of that proposition that we should potentially restrict? I don't mean to mischaracterize it, Claire, but you know, basically to emphasize the point, maybe restrict the typology to a certain kind of accommodation. And we are talking about kind of basically young people or maybe people in my age, Claire. I'm not too worried about being over 50 at this point. but Frank, over to you on that.
I can completely agree with kind of Claire's points. What's quite interesting is that statistics that you just mentioned, if I understand them correctly, you know, if 5% is potentially a suitable proportion of people who may live in, let's say, towers, not just tall buildings, but your calculations suggest that we are nowhere near 5% yet. And I think it's an interesting point that the focus and the attention and the assumptions people make about tall buildings may be disproportionate, because people see a tall building and they go and think, oh, massive, it's got 400 homes in this one tower. And they forget that, you know, the number of homes when you look across out of the window from that tall building over Victorian streets of London, there are very, very large numbers of homes in London. And we're not, I don't think anybody in this, any of us here are suggesting we replace everything with tall buildings. We're not talking about a kind of utopian situation where we switch to a different form of development. So I kind of actually took positively from that, that there's not that many in terms of homes provided in that format. But I think the challenge that Claire is particularly focused on here, which I think is very valid, is when you talk about the difference between private homes and you talk about social housing. Where you're telling people where to live is a very different story when people choose where to live. I mean, and I think people who are renting or buying homes may well see benefits in tall buildings, sunshine and views, especially in cities where you've got limited access to that. It's a form of amenity, which is very valuable. But I agree, you have to pay for it, really. And tall buildings, maybe this comes back to the kind of wider points about the sustainability. Tall buildings are more expensive structures to build. Per home, there's substantially more engineering, physicality, the structure itself. Obviously, one structure that supports one floor is all supporting the one above it. And obviously, that progression gets quite significant when you get to many, many stories. So you're building more stuff, you're embodying more carbon, and you're building much more sophisticated buildings. You know, we know that they're harder to maintain because fire systems, cladding systems, window systems that are 20 stories high fundamentally are designed to a much more sophisticated engineering level. So all of that is true. So they have to be chosen carefully. Personally, I think the benefits, where appropriate, can still be worth it, because if we don't build tall buildings where it's appropriate at the right level, we will lose the green belt, which I think is a greater loss for our total social balance. There's that trade-off to be considered.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that there's sort of broad agreement, and I would agree too with many of Claire's observations. There's no oversupply of them, effectively, what we're saying. The issue really is about making them available to the right sort of occupier or tenant or owner, or however you describe that. And Frank, I think your point is very valid about perceptions, really, because they are such prominent forms of development that sometimes their impact socially is perhaps distorted. But that's very helpful. So I move on to, and seems naturally, to the topic of, and maybe we've covered it, I don't know, but I think there's probably more to say about managing the needs of different tenures effectively within that. And, you know, what are the barriers to developers facing? You know, what barriers are developers facing to dealing with that? And maybe, Frank, you know, working a lot with private developers, maybe I'll start you off on that.
Well, to continue my optimistic trend, we have one development which I'm quite pleased with, which is one of the early developments that's going to happen in the Park Royal area, where we've created a family block, which is a low-rise, five-story courtyard building with 100% family units, and then a linear block, which is two-bedroom homes, which is about eight stories, and then attached to that is a tower, small tower, 20 stories, which is 100% one beds. So we've actually separated the kind of unit sizes completely into different zones in this single development, which shares various communal spaces at ground floor. But that then is coupled with a build-to-rent model and discount market rent model for the affordable provision. And I think what arises with a build-to-rent model like that is that people can move tenure without moving home, or they can move home as their needs change. And I think this is a model that's not very natural in the UK. The UK kind of psychology is buy your home as early as you can, house is your castle, and that's your home for life. And you know, we used to have building for life as a standard, which embodied that kind of concept. But in a more agile future, perhaps with a higher proportion of renting people and people moving and only building what people need, I think it's quite exciting that people could rent a property or a home suitable to their needs. Don't have your children, for example. They could rent a small home. They then get married. They then move elsewhere in the same development. They perhaps move between being qualifying for an affordable product and getting a discount on their rent, but then they're very fortunate enough to progress and no longer qualify, but then they don't want to move home. So that's fine, because their lease agreement effectively changes. They don't have to move home. So I would like to decouple the idea that the physical property is badged with its affordable status. That should really just be a kind of financial transaction, so that you get more agility and you get more pepper potting effectively happening.
Claire, do you want to come back on some of those points?
Yeah, sure. I suppose when I think of different tenures, I literally think about people on different incomes. That is all we mean, essentially, when we're talking about different tenures. A household is a household is a household. The thing that they will have a differential on is really what they can afford to live in. So for me, is a tall building okay for people on lower incomes? Now, I've already gone off on one earlier and said that The World's End is fantastic. What I could never get out of KNC was, what is the service charge? And I suspect that KNC must subsidise that to a degree, because I suspect the upkeep of that building is, as Frank has already mentioned, pretty tricky. Actually, new builds are even worse, because there is, as he mentions, a lot of complex M&E, all the maintenance needs to be done at height, which needs special equipment, etc. So to me, it all comes down to, and this sounds rather dull, but service charges. You look at the Barbican, the service charges are around £8,000 a year for, you know, a typical home there. We all know who can afford that. Now, of course, social tenants don't have to pay those charges. It's all met by the landlord, or a lot of it's met by the landlord. But actually, they still do need to meet, some of them, to the tune of about £30 or £40 a week, which is pretty difficult. So either they're crippled, or actually their landlord is finding that they're crippled because they're having to pay a lot for the upkeep of this building, which the rents simply don't cover. The other thing that's important is, when I did the social research with some other colleagues on what residents who have low incomes in high-rise actually want and think, the absolute key was security and safety. Now, you know, who knew? But actually, what that means is, and what came out of it was, please, 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 can we have a concierge? Now, that's about the least affordable thing you could possibly do. But actually, when you've got a tower with a lot of stories, a lot of people in different places that don't necessarily know each other, there's something fantastic about a unifying figure on the ground floor that welcomes you, that represents security, etc., etc. That is what all households want, and it's the least affordable thing for the residents that perhaps need that presence the most. So the other thing about ground and first floor of taller buildings is, to my mind, there should be a planning rule or some kind of guidance in various planning documents that says those have to be given up to community amenities of various kinds, and a management plan for those has to be made and somehow subsidised by the person that wants to create that taller block, because it makes a massive difference in the life of that block. I still think there are too many taller buildings going up which are blind at that ground floor and therefore don't serve their residents and don't serve the wider public.
Well, thanks, Clara. And here I'm just going to, in a sense, play the personal card, which, as a New Yorker, I've actually lived in tall buildings. And you're absolutely right. There's a massive difference between a concierge building and a non-concierge building. It's absolutely true. You know, and the American model, or let's even think of the continental model, the conversation really circles back to, inevitably, the ownership and development models that we have for residential development in this country. I mean, let's remember that the way we do development here is, you know, reflects property law and things like that. And we think, you know, the way London developed with housing after the Great Fire was on the basis of, you know, builders coming in on 3-year leases they took from ground landlords, did their development, issued a lease, and exited the picture, and therefore made all their money, actually, in the building and disposal within a relatively short period of time. And so, you know, Claire, I wonder if you just want to pick up that point, really, and we can explore it a little bit, because I think it's fundamental.
I think it is. And the UK model of development is almost entirely build it, flog it and go, which does not incentivize long-term robustness, tenant retention, all of that kind of thing. Of course, social landlords are playing a very different game. They are there for the long term. But I would still suggest that building an entire tall building with lower income residents is probably going to be difficult for them and the residents in the end. The interesting one, of course, which Frank's already touched on, is build to rent. There is a new institutional tenure in this country, which is actually now 16% of London's new housing delivery. I didn't realise that, and it's pretty astonishing. But the rents in there are massive. I can't afford them, to be frank. they're sort of $2,000 to $3,000, you know, for a 2 or 3 bed unit in there. Now, all of your bills are paid, which is very interesting. And I wonder what's going to happen when the bills go through the roof, whether the, because the rents can't go up too much. People will simply walk away. So my worry is that the extra cost of making these taller buildings has to be covered by the income. And I do worry about the income in perpetuity and whether it really is robust enough, whether, you know, the absolute worst case, we'll, in 40 or 50 years, we'll see these buildings being abandoned because the owners, the build-to-rent owners, simply do not have the income coming in to undertake the maintenance, which we all know is quite tricky.
And interestingly, that you make that point, because again, drawing on my deeper past, that's exactly the point that was reached in New York in the 1980s. And as a consequence, tall buildings went into cooperative ownership, which presents their own, its own set of issues, certainly not socially inclusive. And again, that is an astonishing figure, 16%. But as you say, not really by any means socially accessible, if we can put it that way. I mean, Frank, what about your experience? I think particularly on the private side, and thinking about some of the big players in the field and the way they're viewing housing as an investment.
I think the only time I feel like the developers are able to make progress in doing the right thing seems to be when they change their attitude towards development. And it's built to the developers we've worked with who are looking at things through a build-to-rent model seem to be leaps ahead. Now, I'm not saying it's only build-to-rent. Fundamentally underpinning the thinking is the long-term, is the fact it's long-term investment rather than short-term investment. And what we've been seeing is, just like we have in pretty much every other sector in lifestyle, with this shift from ownership to kind of service, kind of cultural change that we've seen over the last 20 years, where you don't own your car really anymore. You just have a lease and you subscribe to things. It's about lifestyle. So in the build-to-rent model, people are moving their mentality to a subscription mentality. Pay rent, you live here, and it's more than just bricks and mortar. It's service, it's drop-off, it's deliveries, it's lifestyle, it's community. That can all be very good. I agree with Claire, though, it is more expensive. But I think where the possible coming together, the separation of housing associations from private developers, I don't think it's very good. Because what we see is developers where they carve off a bit, and housing association does one bit, manages it and runs it on a different budget. That doesn't work either because that creates a poor door. But where we see a blended approach, where a single organization with a long-term view is able to start to say, we've got a portion of private rental and we've got a portion of social rental, then the subsidization is actually happening through the institution rather than just at the point of the government subsidies. So therefore, service charges paid by the private renters or the private owners actually subsidize the affordable tenures as well. And I think that can be where it can work. That's where the investment can come. But it does mean developers have got to shift their heads into residual values in 25 years' time rather than what they're going to get, you know, the day after the building's finished, that has to end, because that has been a responsibility for downgrading the quality of buildings, building inappropriate homes that aren't actually suitable for different people's needs because they're just the smallest boxes you can possibly get on an estate agent's page.
But Frank, could I challenge you a bit? Because a lot of the build-to-rent buildings, especially tall buildings, I'm seeing going up around the place at the moment, and I'm certainly not pointing at yours or anyone's in particular, but I do see some when I'm going through on railway tracks normally, which are so badly built, I can already see that they're a problem, and it makes me really nervous. My other thing I wanted to quickly put in is that in the 20s and 30s, there was loads of institutional investment in build to rent, and they flogged it all off after the war because the kind of investment environment changed. So yes, it's supposedly a long-term play, but I do sometimes wonder, especially in London, whether people are really committed to that.
Well, it is a good point. You know, it's interesting. Across the whole of this discussion, we find ourselves circling back to, I guess, what I would call an estate-led long-term investment model for the delivery of tall buildings in a socially inclusive and sustainable way, because that enables, you know, quality of accommodation, flexibility. Frank's point, which I thought was well made, about moving around developments as your circumstances change and so forth. But we come up against a very hard reality of actually the way we do development in this country, leaving finances aside for a moment, the way, you know, a poor old planning authority has to decide what to do with a piece of land that comes forward in a highly sustainable location, opportunity area, etc., where they have absolute obligation to maximize the delivery of housing as a policy objective. But they also have an obligation to provide family accommodation. And there is, in my mind anyway, a real mismatch here between professionally what we can agree is probably a great approach and actually the way land comes forward for development. And we have to bear in mind, of course, that, you know, land comes forward in that way because we live in a liberal democracy, which is respects private property rights, and local authorities don't, or rarely and reluctantly, use their powers for compulsory purchase to assemble comprehensive estates. And it's an unbelievably lengthy process. So, I have experience of it, I can tell you, and I'm sure you guys do too, but is that a fair characterization, do you think? Because we're moving between this idea of, we've got this piece of land, develop it, meet local authority housing requirements in all respects, flog it, and this other model. Maybe, Frank, I could ask you to comment on that.
I'll pick up on one of the points you make about the way land comes forward. I think it's one of a bugbear I have. I'm an advocate for stronger planning frameworks. I think kind of a liberally interpreted but not crystal clear planning policy causes part of the problem. So where there is pressure on councils to deliver housing, and where land comes forward through a private purchase arrangements, basically the purchasers speculate on what's going to get built on that land, and it goes to the highest bidder, and it usually goes to the bidder who's least informed and did the least due diligence. And then we get stuck with land which has been overpurchased and land prices which are inflated, and therefore the only way to then exit that is to maximize development. And I think fundamentally to the point we're all talking about here, whether it's super tall or medium tall, or whether it's tall to kind of mid-rise, in order to provide really good housing that's inclusive, not just affordable, not affordable, but also inclusive for all tenures, you need to relax a little bit. You need a bit more space. You 100% need one, two, possibly three floors worth of community facilities at the lower levels. You need open space. You need gardens. You need units to be larger. You need breakout space. You need children's play areas at the right parts of the buildings. And all of that takes space. So I would prefer if we had clearer planning frameworks, which meant there was no argument about what's going to fit on the site, whether it's plot ratios or actual housing capacities that sit in policy. So when someone's buying a piece of land, they're going to put 100 homes on it. No one else is going to come forward and go, I can get 150 on there, and then pay too much for the land and downgrade the quality of the housing.
Well, thanks for that. We had a really good airing of the social side of things, but of course the social has a broader component to that, which is also environmental sustainability. And I sort of flagged it at the beginning around my, you know, where I said that possibly carbon discuss was going to come up in a number of these. And it's until this point, it probably hasn't very much, which is interesting in itself. But maybe, Claire, could I ask you just to address that point about environmental sustainability in relation to tall buildings?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Here's another place where research is thin on the ground, or good research is thin on the ground. Of course, you get the advocates that say the land take of a tall building is much smaller. Isn't that better? Because you've got a lot of people in a dense area supporting other amenities and making the city work. But I think that has to be really carefully weighed up against the embodied carbon issues, the fact that you're using a lot more material because your structure is far more substantial and so on. And then the operational carbon environmental impacts of wind and having to deal with overheating and everything else. I think we need a sort of very clear, and it should be simple and not complicated, toolkit of some kind to assess what is the optimal building on this site with respect to sustainability. Because I think people are going to make the land take arguments all day long, because they say much needed new housing. And I think the other side are going to differ. I know some very, very credible senior level architects in a couple of practices who actually do not think we should build over 10 stories ever again. I won't say who they are, but and I'm sure they would say it themselves if they were here. But, you know, this is now critical to get to the bottom of in sort of very technical terms so that we don't all just bandy around our preferred arguments about what is sustainable and what isn't.
Yeah. So, Frank, come back on that point, the sort of hard carbon point, really.
I think, I mean, we did some initial, we were discussing internally with our own carbon team and saying that fundamentally, if you want to build the lowest carbon solution, you don't build anything over about 6 stories, you know, and that's the optimal. You know, building one story housing is high carbon too, because there's too much roof. So there's a kind of optimum there, which is your kind of, you know, the Kensington model that people have touted, you know, the Kensington mansion block model, which is just everyone got quite excited about in the 2000s. And there's that kind of mid-density thing. I think there's a strong case for that. I think it comes back to the point you're making earlier that tall buildings have a role to play, but it's a small percentage. It's a small percentage for people who want them, people who value them, a certain type of sector of households it's appropriate for, but it's limited. And I actually agree that we shouldn't be replacing mid-rise development. I think mid-rise development has a really, really important role to play. I think the challenge we've got is to avoid kind of switching out from kind of tall buildings to kind of detached housing. The most challenging form of housing development that I have more problems with is the kind of parochial cul-de-sac based, everything's a detached house so that you can say it is, but they effectively touch each other, developments which are high in land take and they're not very dense and they don't have any amenity. But we are starting to see those changing. I'm encouraged. I've driven past developments where you're starting to see small apartment buildings being incorporated into those, which allow the density to go up. And then you're starting to see community facilities being included in those kind of master plans as well. And I think that medium density, more urban development, especially for smaller towns and cities where there's town expansion, is entirely appropriate. Right in the centre of London, we've already done that, but that's where perhaps the levelling up agenda could be relevant here, because there's lots of land in cities in the north where it just not developed with, and where councils could get in, and there's definitely space for mid-rise homes in there, which we think could work very well.
Well, I think that's a good point to begin to draw all this together. It seems to me what we're saying on the carbon point is that it probably has to be looked at across the whole of the city, really. Then, and Claire, your point about, and there's agreement, and based on what I understand, as a humble planner, there's agreement too, that you're not going to get these buildings to a kind of net zero carbon point. But the calculation and the assessment of that, it seems to me, is not just about the physical components of a building and its production and its performance, but it also comes down to carbon savings from the concentration of people in particular locations which are sustainable. And once you begin to think about that, the calculations actually become impossible, don't they? Because you're talking about describing whole economic systems. And, you know, even the simplest economic models we all know are subject to, even economists themselves say, are subject to a high level of skepticism and utility and of limited usefulness. But I think unless either of you has a burning concluding observation to make, and I'll sort of open the floor at that point, but, Claire, you want to say something further, final?
In summary, I would just say the high cost of building it, the high cost of operating it, and the potential high environmental impact these buildings have really should make us all consider what we're doing when we're making tall resi.
Hmm. Frank, any final observation from you?
If we should consider what we're doing, I think in that consideration, I think there's a residual role to play, but it can be a lot more inclusive and a lot better. We should be going back to World's End and well beyond, and I think there is capacity to be a lot better than that, but I don't think they're going to answer everything.
Well, thank you very much for your contribution. I found it fascinating, and I think that probably draws our discussion to an end. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Chris, and thanks again to our guests today, Frank and Claire. We do hope you've enjoyed this episode of City Bites. If you go to the website at futureoflondon.org.uk, you can find links to other episodes of the City Bites podcast on a wide range of topics. Don't forget to watch out for further episodes in the City of Tomorrow series, sponsored by Montague Evans, coming in the near future. For now, thanks and goodbye.